A grand jury in New York voted yesterday to indict former President Donald Trump on criminal charges, the first time a former U.S. president has been charged with a crime. There's a lot we don't know at this point. Specific charges, for example, aren't currently public. They're expected to be unsealed in the coming days. But the case relates to the cover-up of a payment that Trump attorney Michael Cohen made to adult film actress Stormy Daniels in the days before the 2016 election to keep quiet about an alleged sexual encounter with Trump. The charges are separate from other investigations involving the former president, including probes into his role in the January 6th insurrection and his handling of classified documents. We're taking a closer look at the story and what to expect from a grand jury indictment like this. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the indictment of former President Trump? What it means to indict a former president? Are you worried about the precedent it sets? What is your reaction? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Howard Schwaber is professor of political science at UW-Madison and an affiliate professor at the law school. He's an expert on constitutional law. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
A lot of emotions, I think, across the political spectrum, Howard. I want to dig into something on the procedural side of things, though. The use of a grand jury. When does a prosecutor say, you know, I'm not going to go for an indictment of my own. I'm going to convene this grand jury to review the case.
The rules are different in different states. There's always some initial proceeding in which the prosecutor, before we get to trial, you know, before anything else, has to come to a court and show, I have enough to say that there's a plausible possibility of a crime here, a reason to go forward at all. In a lot of states, that's an arraignment. In the federal system, it's a grand jury. In New York, it's a grand jury. So, I mean, that's just an idiosyncrasy mm-hmm. of different practices. Historically, the idea was the grand jury would be a check on prosecutors. You had to bring in members of the community and persuade them you were not politically persecuting someone or pursuing a personal vendetta or following a charge with no reason. In fact, in practice, it doesn't really work that much as a check because in the grand jury proceeding, only the prosecutor gets to talk. There are no defense witnesses. There's no defense lawyer. There's no cross-examination. This is not a determination of guilt or innocence. This is only a threshold determination of is there anything here at all to go forward to a criminal charge. And the most famous description is any competent prosecutor should be able to get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich.
Right. An indictment is not a conviction. What do you watch for now with the next steps after this news of the indictment came out?
So the indictment means that the grand jury concluded, yes, Mr. Prosecutor, there's something here. You have reason to go forward and file some charges. What we don't know is what those charges are. I saw something today that said there are 34 of them, which is a remarkably large number. On the other hand, the number of charges all depends on how the prosecutor chooses to frame them. For example, supposing the crime involves false statements. Well, if you charge each false statement as a separate indictment or separate clause of the indictment, you know, those numbers can get large very quickly. Until we know what the charges actually are, we're dealing with a lot of guesswork and a lot of speculation based on some background knowledge, of course.
Now, this is a prosecution of a former president, and there are two principles I've heard from people. One, everybody's equal under the law. Being a former president and running for office again shouldn't exempt you from being prosecuted. On the other hand, there's a principle that we shouldn't use the courts to target people based on their political background. So maybe we should have a higher bar for someone in that situation to avoid the reality or perception that we're targeting someone for political reasons. How do we balance those?
Yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, on a case-by-case basis, those are both valid principles. Those are both absolutely valid principles. I'll make an analogy if I can. In a baseball game, over the course of the game, the umpire calls a certain kind of strike zone, and the players get used to a certain kind of strike zone. If in the last inning he suddenly starts calling a very different strike zone, it's still the case he's applying the rules, but he might be violating a norm of the sport. And you'll have vivid, you know, enthusiastic debates among sports fans. The recent Super Bowl had a holding call that was one of these situations about which is more important, applying the rule in a particular case or being consistent with the norms of practice over a period of time. It's not clear in this case, which of those pieces applies more than the other. It's worth noting that Michael Cohen, who is involved, of course, in the payoff process, has spent time in prison for this illegal payment. So there's something slightly ironic about saying President Trump cannot be indicted for an action that his subordinates have already spent time in prison for. On the other hand, you can, as you suggested, argue that a great deal of deference is owed. And very much, and the benefit of doubt also ought always to be given in a situation where there is the not just potential, but certainty that people will complain this is political and this may raise more distrust in the system and more anger among the population.
Talking to Howard Schwaber, professor of political science at UW-Madison, affiliate professor at the law school, looking at the New York grand jury decision to issue indictments for former President Trump. This in the case related to money paid to Stormy Daniels to, in effect, according to the charges against Michael Cohen, by her silence in the run-up to Election Day. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Crash is with us in Milwaukee. Crash, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I'm just not concerned about this being a precedent. In fact, I welcome the precedent of a former United States president, if there's wrongdoing, being prosecuted. I think it's very democratic and very American.
Crash, thanks for the call and for illustrating a challenge of my job where I have to say precedent and president again and again. But Howard, to Crash's point, he's okay with this precedent of issuing charges against a former president.
I think Crash's point is an excellent one, and he has a really very well-informed take. And what I mean by that is we were just saying, you know, is it a problem that this is contrary to some past tradition of deference? Well, of course, to answer that question, you have to ask, do you approve of that? Is it a good tradition? A huge set of questions were asked, for example, after the actions of the Bush administration after 9/11 and Americans' involvement in torture, should there be charges brought against government officials? And we had these same kind of debates. No, it's a bad precedent, but yes, we must enforce the law. But one thing that can certainly be argued is until there start being legal consequences for criminal activity by high officials, they will feel immune to engage in that activity. And that's a pattern we do see around the world, not just in the United States. And so I think, you know, people of intelligence and goodwill can disagree with Crash's point, but I think he makes an excellent one. I do have to correct the historical record just slightly. This is not the first president to be arrested. Sitting President Ulysses S. Grant was arrested for speeding in Washington, D.C. He was driving his carriage with two high-stepping horses too fast. A police officer named William H. West, who was a Black Civil War veteran, reluctantly but dutifully arrested him and issued a $20 fine, which Grant did not show up in court to contest.
Was he indicted at any point, though? I guess the
it wasn't an indictment system. It was merely a traffic ticket.
Okay, so I'll be careful to say first indicted, not first arrested. Thank you.
And first ex-president, not right, because Grant was sitting president. So you're fine.
Crash, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Steve joins us now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Yeah, this stuff has been going on now for years, this Trump derangement syndrome, where they just want to get Trump. And Trump is going to go away. Are they going to move? Are the Democrats going to move on to just another Republican and have DeSantis derangement syndrome like they had Walker derangement syndrome? Where is this going to end?
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. And Howard, to Steve's point, especially when it comes to court cases, the perception from Steve, and not just Steve, that some prosecutors around the country are looking for something to indict former President Trump for.
So, I mean, the phrase Trump derangement syndrome, and by the way, before that, there was Obama derangement syndrome. I think that's the earliest use of that particular phrase I've heard, but I'm sure there are others. The first, the idea that where there is a certain president in power, his political opponents will find any reason in any measure and believe any theory to try and discredit him. It's certainly a fair concern. Obviously, the counter-argument is, what if crimes have actually been committed? And, you know, when we see the charges unveiled, we'll know a little bit more. There does seem to be substantial evidence to support the argument that crimes have been committed, both in this case and in other prosecutions against Donald Trump. And if that's true, you know, one could conceivably be confronted by a situation in which there is simultaneously a derangement syndrome causing people to pursue crimes and actual crimes to be committed. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean you don't have real enemies. Well, this is a sort of the reverse of that. So we'll sort of have to wait and see. I don't think I can think of some Democratic officials who have displayed what Steve is calling Trump derangement syndrome. I don't think any of the three current ongoing investigations, which are likely to lead to indictments, can be dismissed quite that easily.
Steve, thanks a lot for calling in. We're talking to Howard Schwaber from UW-Madison, political scientist, constitutional law expert, looking at the news of former President Trump being indicted by a grand jury yesterday. What we know, what we don't know, and what to expect in the days to come. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions you have about what's normal in the process of an indictment, how it might be a little less normal given the person involved and his position, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Howard Schwaber, professor of political science at UW-Madison, constitutional law expert, looking at the indictment of former President Trump in connection with the cover-up of a hush money payment to Stormy Daniels in the days leading up to the 2016 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Howard, before I go back to our callers, I want you to put on your political scientist hat here. A lot of people looking at the political fallout from all of this in the 2024 elections. I want to shorten the time horizon. We have this election coming up here on Tuesday for state Supreme Court, nonpartisan, technically clear partisan favorites. Do you think there's any way this indictment stirs up, has an impact on voting turnout or behavior for that election?
For the judicial election, I doubt it. There's so much at stake in this judicial election on both sides. I know this is a different topic, but you know, reflect for a moment that if you are a pro-life Wisconsin voter, you spent your whole life waiting for this opportunity. If you're a pro-choice Wisconsin voter, you spent your whole adult life, or possibly your whole life, you know, not having to be concerned about this kind of possible outcome. Suddenly, those things are on the table. I think there's so much at stake in this Wisconsin judicial election just for Wisconsin that the national electoral politics is kind of secondary.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jim joins us now in Ellsworth. Jim, hi.
Hi. I guess my concern is if they do not hold officials like the president accountable, that sets a horrible precedent, and it's dangerous for our democracy. I mean, you go back to, Richard Nixon and saying whatever he did when he was president was legal because he was president, or, you know, like the unitary theory of the presidency. And Dick Cheney supported that as well. And I think, you know, he and Bush were accountable for war crimes, basically, that they were never charged for. And it goes on and on. So Nixon was pardoned, and then Reagan had Iran-Contra. And so these people don't think they're going to ever be held accountable. And I think that's really dangerous for our democracy.
Jim, thanks for the call. Howard, what do you think?
Well, it's unquestionably a valid point. The counterpoint, of course, is if legal proceedings become political weapons, that is destabilizing for democracy in a different way. In support of the caller's point, though, you know, it's worth remembering that a lot of the folks who were involved in the Watergate shenanigans later showed up in the Reagan administration. Some of them were then pardoned by George H.W. Bush, and they went on to show up in the Iraq War lead up. So, I mean, in other words, in the absence of prosecutions, the same actors have a tendency to show up again and again in situations that are either scandalous or questionable or at least causes for concern. So both sides of that argument have really valid points. I think it is very fair to say that there cannot, that it is unwholesome and even and destructive to have a norm that says high-ranking officials are immune from prosecution. It's equally fair to say, you know, if you're going to bring a prosecution against a highly public figure who's important to the national political scene, it better be for something real, and you'd better have a good case.
Thanks a lot for that call. Steve joins us now in Madison. Steve, hi.
Hi. My question has to do with any similarities or comparisons with Ken Starr chasing Hillary Clinton, and I think also Bill Clinton around for, it seems like, endless years. Is this really so unique, I guess? And I guess we might question whether one was more politically motivated than the other, or one had more of a legal basis than the other, but it doesn't seem to me that the Republicans have anything to call foul about it.
I got you, Steve. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Howard, compare and contrast for us.
Right, and before that, there was the Iran-Contra investigation by Democrats against Republicans. There's certainly a long history of using special prosecutor congressional investigations in ways that the other side always claims are politically partisan. These indictments, the one in New York and the one coming out of Georgia, are a little different in the sense that they are local or state prosecutors rather than Congress taking this action. And so I guess there's a fear that the politicization of the prosecutorial process is spreading. But I certainly think it's true that neither party and people from neither party are in a safe space to say, I'm shocked, you know, to discover there's politics going on in the investigation of presidents.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Ross joins us now in Wauwatosa. Ross, hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. I'm just wondering why would anybody constrain ourselves to norms when former President Trump violated all norms in all convention. If somebody could explain that, it'd be helpful. Thanks, Howard.
Thanks for the call, Ross.
Ross makes a lovely point. And it's actually not just Trump. Mitch McConnell in the Senate is another example. You know, there's a thing that political scientists refer to as constitutional hardball, which is public officials pushing their authority right to the limit through all norms, through all accepted limitations to limit what's legally allowed. And no one has done that more in recent years than Donald Trump, Mitch McConnell, and some of the other leading Republicans. So sort of like the last call, you know, it's a little bit ironic or even amusing to hear Republicans now complaining that norms are being violated when for the last decade, Republican leadership has left norms trampled in the dust. The problem is that, you know, regardless of whose fault it is or who did it first or who's doing it more, it's a very unwholesome process. And it is democracy. I think there's a general agreement among people who study these questions that democracies that are not buttressed by supportive norms that sort of put a fence around the legal rules. So there are legal limits, but there are also people won't get too close to those legal limits because it would just be considered not the way we are supposed to do things. Without those sorts of norms, democracies become unstable. And there's a lot of literature on that. And so, you know, it's very easy to have to understand the sense of gotcha. You did it, now we're doing it. But it's not a healthy way to do politics.
Yeah, thanks a lot for that call. If we want to keep norms anywhere, Howard, it seems like prosecution. That would be a pretty good place to continue observing our norms.
Well, it is a good place because prosecutors have so much discretion. Our whole system is built on the idea that prosecutors, for example, don't have to bring charges if they're not going to win. So when you hear about a prosecutor with a 100% conviction record, that's not nearly as impressive as it sounds. He or she didn't have to bring any case unless they were sure they were going to win it. They get to choose what charges to file. They get to choose what kind of plea bargains to make. They have just an enormous, arguably constitutionally dubious amount of discretion as to what actually happens in criminal trials. And for people given that much discretion, it's even more important that they show some respect for norms and practices. I do not mean to suggest that Alvin Bragg is not doing that. As I said at the outset, if there are grounds for a serious criminal charge, it should be brought. And I don't think there's any basis, at least from what we've seen so far, to claim that his prosecution and Fannie Willis's prosecution in Georgia and Jack Smith's investigation in the Department of Justice, you know, are the kind of norm-busting hardball that we're concerned about. But that is certainly something to watch for.
Let's go now to Brad in West Salem. Brad, hello.
Hi. I just want to preface, I'm a constitutionalist. I don't have a party. I was listening to your program. The other earlier caller had stated about the like the imagination of Democrats that they're on this prosecution. And I just had the wonder and the thought that maybe is it that maybe the Republicans might be getting upset so much about this because, as one of our great founders said, he's doing something that they told us to do. You know, it's your job to avoid paying taxes. So I wonder if maybe the Republicans don't see quite how bad Trump is because it's something on a much less, more subtle manner. A lot of us follow every time we do our taxes, every time, you know, we have to go to the city to get licensing or something. We want to try and avoid paying as much as possible. So I just wonder if maybe that might be why some of the Trump voters are so upset about the prosecution of Donald Trump.
Brad, thanks a lot for the call. Howard, I think clearly the political response thus far, people see the legal issues at stake often through a partisan lens here.
Very much so. Although I'm not sure that's what the caller was doing. There's a very big topic here about ideas of virtue and whether we think our leaders should be better than us or just like us. Trump brought the same kind of norm-busting, hardball, push-everything-to-the-wall approach that he had taken in law as a real estate developer. He brought that to politics. And, you know, that's one of the things that happened. He has been a guy willing to push the very, very boundary of breaking the law all the time, for decades. And on questions like taxes, when he very forthrightly said, of course I try not to pay taxes, that's because I'm smart. You know, that rung a bell. It is interesting to note that, at least based on early polling results, the fact of the indictment has bolstered Trump's position among Republicans. They are gathering around him, circling the wagons, if you like. Even as other interviews suggest that Republicans on the Hill, members of Congress, are much less eager about having him as their candidate. So in terms of the political effect, if anything, this is causing both sides to dig in, which I think is, frankly, pretty predictable.
Howard, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That's Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and law expert at UW-Madison, with us to talk about what we do and don't know about yesterday's grand jury vote indicting President Trump on criminal charges. We'll watch to see what those charges are when they're made public in the coming days.